Danon Nutritia Campus is an open science education platform for healthcare professionals overseen by a not-for-profit foundation. The foundation is led by an independent board of medical professionals and academics with one clear goal: to advance the field of nutrition and health from infancy to old age through growing knowledge, training and education of healthcare professionals around the world in collaboration with medical and scientific communities.
This is the third and last podcast in a series about the teenage brain, its development, and how to best support our PKU teens during their transition into adulthood. I'm Kirsten Arring, metabolic dietitian based in Copenhagen, Denmark, and I'm joined by Bettina Honen and Jane Gilmore, clinical psychologists from the UK, both specializing in the teenage development and education.
Hi, Kirsten. Very nice to see you today. My name's Bettina Honen. I'm a clinical psychologist with specializing in child mental health and working in neurodiversity. And I hold a position at UCL. I have an academic background and I'm very keen on trying to interpret science and neuroscience and what it means for parents, for particularly teenagers and professionals.
Thank you very much. And Jane?
Hi, and I'm Jane Gilmore, and I'm a consultant clinical psychologist at Great Ormond Street Hospital here in London, and also a course director on a child development master's course at University College London. And also with Bettina and our colleague Tara Murphy, we've written the book The Incredible Teenage Brain, which is our main remit today, to talk about how to support a young person as they go through adolescence.
Thank you very much, and that's great to have you with us for the third time. I have quite a lot of experience now with PKU after 23 years in the clinic, almost 24, and I've seen quite a few very easy children develop into very difficult teenagers, being very rebellious, risk-taking, obnoxious, don't want to listen. And the parents have tried to ask me to help them, and when I try to talk to these children, they don't even want to talk to me. They look down on the smartphone. Maybe they were dragged all the way into clinic, sitting there in front of me, and yet they don't even want eye contact. Some of them tells me later on, 10 years later down the road, when they are back to normal, saying, well, when I was a teenager, I would get up in the middle of the night and go down and into the fridge just to check what would happen. Would I be brain dead when I wake up in the morning? And then I will assume my parents, they were just lying and trying to control me. And they would tell me about all kinds of issues they've had and how difficult they understand now it was to be a parent to a PKU child. So what can we do to help them and avoid these episodes?
Well, I think the first thing to do, and I always think the best first step is to think about understanding the context. And that's not necessarily doing something different, it's understanding what's going on differently. And there is an element of truth that the teenage years are rebellious years. That is true, particularly when young people are around their friends. And this is in part because it's a high risk activity. It has a high value if it turns out well. And of course, when we're around our peers, we, as we know from our last podcast, one of the key aspects of a teenager's sort of remit is to look like a high status person within their community. So doing those, taking those risks or telling their friends about taking those risks is something that they're driven to do. And being rebellious is actually, it's got lots of wonderful things about it because it's revisionist. It's saying, you know, let's not do what we were doing before. Let's do something different. I'm not doing that. I'm doing something else. Now, as a community, we all really benefit from that because, you know, if you think about all the sort of wonderful, let's say, you know, think about Steve Jobs, for example. He did some extraordinary revolutionary thinking during his teenage years, essentially, because that capacity to go out with the old and in with the new is part of that rebellion. It's also part of separating from the family. Now, of course, we learned from our previous podcast that we've got to become an independent adult. And that means separating from what the family say or do so that I can be an independent person myself. So part of that will be rejecting what the family say and finding something out for myself. Does it work for me? Can I survive by myself? Can I do something differently? Now, all of those things do have benefits for the society and benefits, of course, for the learning experience for that young person. Because, you know, as we said before, we've got to have these experiences to become a fully formed adult. But when we think about that rebellion or that risk-taking sort of behaviour, there could be some difficulties in the context of PKU. Because what we want to sort of be mindful about is, you know, are we having a situation in which the young person is exploring the world or rebelling against the world using food as the expression for that? Now, that very often happens in all sorts of different contexts. But in the context of PKU, it may have, you know, some significant ramifications. So are they exploring the diet to figure something out? Can they, exactly your case that you raised there, you know, are mom and dad right? Or are they just doing this to just so they can roll my case? Or is there something in this? So I'm going to find this out for myself. And we know that teen brains are wired to explore for themselves. I'll give you one example of this, and we'll talk about it in the book. I call it the lasagna dish principle. I put down a hot lasagna dish in front of a table full of teenagers. I said, don't touch it, it's hot. Now, how many teenagers went to touch the lasagna dish? 100% wanted to find out for themselves that it was indeed hot. Now, that was a perfect example. As Bettina said, if you said a 5 or 10-year-old, don't touch it, they probably wouldn't. So teenagers want to find out for themselves. Now, that means we're in for a bumpy ride, potentially, particularly with the PKU. It also means that particularly in social situations when our friends are around and food is the conduit for that expression, we need to be more mindful.
Yeah, I can see that. That's a very good example of this. Also, I can see things are moving in a positive direction, that it's more and more normal to do maybe extreme sport, to travel, climb mountains, you know, I mean, do extreme travel as well. And more of our patients are doing this. The first one, it's not really always easy to be the first one and do something nobody has ever done before. But now we can refer, if somebody comes and say, I want to go a year to high school in the US, or I want to travel the Amazonas, and say, oh, we have 4 people who did this before you. No problem. You bring this kind of amino acid, it's powder, it's very light, and you can buy the bread here in Rio de Janeiro or whatever. I mean, so we have advices now to make them more brave and they're more risky.
I love that, because a risk isn't necessarily a dangerous risk. A risk is just an outcome in which, you know, the outcome is unknown. And so that is wonderful that you can feed the need for risk taking with these wonderful positive experiences. And in fact, you know, when there was, you know, during the very severe parts of lockdown, which I think many of us had across Europe during the coronavirus, Bettina and I talked a lot about how would teens feed the need for that risk taking and experiential exploration of the world. And, you know, there are lots of ways to feed that need and that positive experience. You could also, you know, by putting yourself out there socially, as far as a teenager is concerned, is the greatest risk you can do. Putting your hand up in class is really, really edgy and dangerous, because your peer group is there looking at you and you're putting yourself in a position that's highly vulnerable. But you can use that as a positive risk as well. You could become an advocate for PKU. You could become an influencer. You could pressurize McDonald's to do a PKU friendly, meal. You know, this is an age of inclusion. This is an age of diversity. What can you do to advocate for PKU? So putting yourself out there in a way that is not necessarily about hanging out in an airplane or going down a ski slope, marvellous those are, is also about embracing the unknown and how that could manifest in all sorts of wonderful positive ways, as well as dangerous risks.
Exactly. And also that we can pretend that this child, this teenager, is very risky, but we are actually keeping an eye, you know, a secret eye. Like an example, one of our young boys, a teenager who wanted to go to the US as an exchange student, the mother was extremely worried. So I found a colleague in the US in Los Angeles. Not only is she a PKU dietitian, she has a PKU girl herself. She's the mother of a PKU. So she was a host family for this PKU boy during 1 year in his teen year, from 16 to 17 or something. So I could relax, the mother in Denmark could relax, because we knew he was in very good hands, but he felt extremely independent, you know. He left to the other part of the world all by himself. And another one is, you know, I'm a member of the ESPKU board, and one of the other members some years ago, his son was traveling Europe and he was going to Copenhagen. And his father called me secretly and said, could you please help if something goes wrong for my son? Can you be there in the background ready to catch him? And say, sure, no problem. But the boy didn't know this. He felt extremely independent with his backpack, you know, in a hotel in Copenhagen. So we can secretly help them to be more brave and more risk-taking, right?
Yeah, and they will rise to the challenge. You know, I think sometimes we really struggle to trust teenagers. We assume that they're going to make bad decisions and do disastrous things. Actually, kids really rise to the challenge when you give them responsibility. Exactly. And I suppose it really makes me also think about the boys sneaking down at night and trying to see what happens. It reminds me a bit of when we work with young people, you know, with drug taking and that kind of thing. And if you say to a young person, you know, if you eat that food, it will damage your brain, or if you smoke one joint, it will damage your brain, and they try it and they go, well, it didn't happen. You know, that's not going to help. We have to be honest. We have to tell them the truth. And the truth, I mean, you know more with PKU, but I think the truth is that a little bit, you're not going to see the effect. Do it once or twice, you're not going to see the effect. There's going to be a long-term effect. It's going to be gradual. So we have to really begin to give them all the information and not hide information from them. I think that strikes me as really important. Building on what Jane has said about this kind of autonomy and independence. So we know that this is a time in life where it is developmentally appropriate for teenagers to want to be independent, to make their own decisions. And as Jane has also said, adults need to make changes in how they relate and talk to teens to kind of reflect that. And in the book, we talk about kind of shifting from being a pilot to being a co-pilot with teenagers. We have this period of 10 years or so when we're alongside them, but they are beginning to take the reins. So I always think it's a bit like, if you imagine, you know, when you're learning to drive, you have the controls, but the person who's sitting next to you, who's teaching you, ultimately can kind of put the foot down. You know, they can hold the kind of the bigger risks in mind, but you're beginning to see what it feels like to do it your way. And there's lots of research now showing that if we tell teenagers what to do without respect for their opinion, it is not going to be effective in changing their behavior. We have to change what we do. So what that means practically, old styles of communication will need to change. So as a professional, little things, I'm sure professionals do this anyway, but talking to the young person and not the parent, you need to shift how you relate to the young person now, beginning to show that in your communication. Listening before giving advice. So always thinking about, you know, this key phrase, what do you think? What do you think is the best way to do it? Rather than jumping in with telling them, list, you know, kind of going through the list again, the things, you know, and they're rolling their eyes and not even listening to you. And giving them autonomy and how to deal with challenges. You've got this is your first time you're going away. What are you going to do? How exciting. It's a great opportunity. I know that you know, you're really saying, you know, I know that you're capable of doing that. Tell me what you're going to do. Be really curious. When things go wrong, also, again, not in the moment when they're in their emotional brain, but when later when you're reflecting on what went wrong, say to them, what do you think happened? I know that when you left here, you wanted to, you know, to stick to your diet, and then something got in the way. And you'll be really surprised by what they'll come up with when they're in the right kind of brain, in a way. And kind of problem solving, brainstorming, really genuinely listening to their suggestions. And then if we just think just a little bit about the executive function skills, actually, we talked about executive function skills in the first episode. So the executive function skills, which are in the prefrontal cortex, they're the last bit of the brain to develop. They are our ability to plan and to organize, to regulate our behavior, to make good decisions, to manage our time, a working memory to remember things. So this period of time, and particularly in the context of PKU, where executive function skills can be a difficulty, is a great time for really teaching them these skills. So a way to do this, just to give a little bit of a template, so is kind of to follow this bit of a structure. So first of all, what we need to do is to reframe the difficulty rather than seeing it as them being lazy or difficult or not trying, kind of reframing it as an executive function skill difficulty. So, for example, if they forgot to take their powder, then we might say, OK, I think that was your working memory in that moment, right? I tell you, I have a poor working memory. And sometimes I think, oh, I must go downstairs and do X. And I get downstairs and I come back up and I'm like, what was I supposed to do? And rather than going, oh, you're so stupid, I can't believe you, just go, okay, that was my working memory.
Good.
I know that that's what let me down. So that's really good, reframing it for them to see that. Also, it enables them to keep a positive self-concept. And then saying, okay, what are the strategies? What can you do next time? So for me, I might say to myself, okay, I know when I go downstairs that I have to remember there's one thing to do. That's what I often do. If there's two things, I remember two things to do. And then Jane's laughing. But with the young person, you actually, tech is really good for this. Can you put a timer on your phone? You know, what can you do? What strategy can you put in place to support you with that? Actually, there's some really good research saying, discuss the barriers, what's going to get in the way. You know, accepting things will get in the way. So I'm making this up for me going downstairs, you know, I might eat some food and then forget what I was doing. But for them, what will get in the way? It may be, you know, when the alarm goes off, I'm really busy chatting with my friends, I don't feel like it. Okay, that might be a barrier. Acknowledge it. Think about how you're going to do that. Okay, when the phone goes off, it's probably important that you act there and then in that moment. And then you come back and you say, how did it go? Now you expect that this is not going to be perfect from the beginning. You expect mistakes. You might expect strategies that you planned didn't work very well. We know that brain circuits change over time. You're going to have to do this a number of times and come back to them again and again and again. Repeat, repeat, repeat. That's how we change the brain. That's how we develop good habits. And if you can do this exercise with them, so reframing strategies, barriers, and then checking in again, then over time, they are going to become much more able to manage those situations by themselves.
That's very interesting and very useful. I will remember your words next time I'm in this situation. So I have another case to present to you today. And I chosen this one because it's a girl that we have had a lot of contact with, trying to help, but without really great luck. She's a 16-year-old classical female girl. She's the oldest of five children, and also one younger sibling has PKU. She feels that her parents have never paid enough attention to her and the PKU diet. They never prepare a proper low-protein meal for her, so she finds forbidden food in the house and eats it in her room. When her parents find out, they have a lot of fights between them. However, they still buy the forbidden foods like candy, chips, and chocolate, even though they know that she eats it. So what can we tell this family? It's very obvious. We should tell them not to buy this food, but they keep doing it. So,
right.
So what do you think?
I mean, that does seem to be one of the most obvious things. There's Absolutely. A number of things yeah. about this case. But I mean, I suppose what you could do is help them to know that there's some really good evidence that availability is linked to behavior. So we have this idea that some people have better willpower than others. Actually, there's lots of really good evidence. It's not just about willpower. It's about, was it easy to do? What's the kind of path of least resistance? So you could help them, you know, to see that. Obviously, it's about how you present it to the family. But actually, the most obvious way to break this cycle is not to have the food in the house. And the other thing we know about parenting or the way in which young people learn, modelling is the most powerful way in which your children learn from you, even teenagers. They are watching what you do every day, what you say, how you live your life. And that is the most powerful way in which they learn. So, yeah, having that conversation with the family and trying to help them to see the importance of that seems to be an important first step.
Mm. I mean, it's interesting as well. I mean, obviously, what Bettina's saying as a first step would be really important. But if we think about what the behaviour is telling us, in some ways, she's saying, I'm struggling, because it's quite an evocative thing that she's doing. She's taking the food and she's hiding it. So, you know, if all behaviour is communication, she's saying in some ways, I'm struggling. It's a bit like, you know, another context, you know, a kid who gets caught shoplifting over and over again isn't saying with words, but it's saying with actions, I'm in trouble here and I don't know how to tell you. So you know, that could be a communication here. So how can she, you know, how can she start to learn to say I'm in trouble, using other means if that's the case? You know, telling her off and say you can't eat that is going to have an effect on your you know, brain function is extremely unlikely to be helpful, as we've talked about before, because she knows that already. I mean, that's not the issue. It's not her misunderstanding. It's something else. I also can't help thinking, no, she's, you know, she's trying to align with the grown-ups in the house. So the grown-ups eat a non-PKU diet. And she's saying, look, I'm like you. You and I, I'm 16. Am I like a grown-up in the house? How else can we describe that? I also would want to know a little bit about, you know, to come back to what Bettina was saying about barriers. You know, why can't the, you know, given there, you know, there's a number of kids in the house that have the same condition, what's getting in the way of the whole family having a PKU friendly diet as far as is palatable and is appropriate? You know, what is getting in the way about, you know, and what's going on there? I think it's concerning about, you know, in terms of the, you know, the pattern there of it being persistent. So somebody, and usually it means the grown-ups in the house, has to do something different, or we're all going to do the same thing over and over again. You know, if we do the same thing over and over again, we're not moving forward. So somebody in the system has to do something different. And ideally that would be the parents. But if it can't be the parents, if they're not able to do that, how could we get inside the system for the young person? You know, what could she do? How could she change the availability of the food in her house? Can she do something proactive and empowering to change it and make it worth her while, so it's got a good reward for her, you know, because she's withholding from doing something? So we have to replace that with a very positive, wonderful reward. Now, whether that is, you know, something that's to do with being an advocate for PKU, or whether that's, you know, having different access to, you know, to something that is that increases her status in her peer group, something like that, that makes it really rewarding to replace the loss of not going back to that food. But I would say that's not the ideal intervention. We'd more likely prefer the grown-ups in the house to make the changes to support the young person, because that's hard. You know, we all want to, you know, take that temptation that's in front of us. And it's much harder if it's in front of us than if it's three doors down.
Absolutely. Yeah. I think we all understand this.
Yeah. I mean, it makes me wonder about, you know, the executive function kind of support maybe the professional could give with her, you know, help her to take greater leadership if her family are not able to do that. And it would mean having some kind of regular check-ins with her, like really regular. I think when you're training executive functions, it needs to be, you know, a few times a week, really. And it can be quite brief, just a brief check-in. You know, how did it go? What strategy did you use today? How effective were you with that? What can really help her keep motivated, I think.
I mean,
so maybe.
Sorry to interrupt. I mean, I'm just thinking as you're saying that, I mean, it could be as something like texting at the professional to say, I didn't eat the food that was in front of me. So she's getting a reward for not doing, as opposed to a momentary rush of eating. So, you know, and that, I mean, I think that's a little bit beyond her pay grade, if you know what I mean, because she's only 16 and it's really hard. But if she could do that, if she could work towards doing that, or even do it once out of 10, that would be an opportunity to praise her, to make her feel like a grown up. And in fact, in some ways, even more emotionally mature than her own parents. So, you know, it would there's opportunities there. One doesn't want to, you know, one wants to work with the family and not divide the family. But, you know, if that's the only way in for her to become an independent person and, you know, emotionally mature and able to do that, then she needs to get applause from somewhere. And, you know, the medical professional could be the one to do that.
Yeah, and that's very important. I mean, that they understand the specific needs in order to ensure good compliance, that they should talk with her and not to her or down to her, not yell at her. I mean, really trying to see her as a person and not just a complicated human being with PKU who takes a special diet. And you can wonder, when they have two PKU children in the house, that they don't take more precautions. But it's hard sometimes to understand the complete picture when we are dealing with a family. So, but definitely, I mean, good support during teenage ages will also maybe ensure an easier adulthood. But I know now, again, when I see the adults now who was teenagers 5 or 10 years ago, I know there's hope. I know there's hope when I see them. So I think it's time to wrap up.
Yeah, I just wanted to say something, Kirsten, because we've been talking a lot about it, about the in some ways there's a huge frustration, I imagine, from a professional point of view, because the science is quite clear, and if you do A, B, and C, then your well-being will be much more positive. That's what we know about the science. But what the professionals are doing here is they're including the human condition into their science. And so it's become an art. You've got to deliver this science, bearing in mind, everybody's emotional state, their stage of development, their, social abilities, your financial abilities, all sorts of things are being mixed in. And so I think from Bettina and I's conversation, we're just talking about it's a real art what you're delivering, a scientific program, which is very, if you do this, if you do X, it will be okay. But it's not as simple as that. This is about the delivery of a program, so it's palatable to a young person and their family. So, we take our hats off to you. I think it's quite a task.
Thank you very much.
Absolutely. Yeah. Shall we end? I mean, we thought we might end with three kind of big takeaways in a way, and we were wondering the best ones. So one, I think, really important one is remembering there is such potential for change and for growth at this time. This extreme plasticity in the brain is available until mid-20s. But young people need support in making those changes. But it's a really important time. I mean, this idea that, young people are adults at the age of 18 is really being thrown out by the new science. They need our support. And it's a really, really important time. Professionals have a really important role during this time. So that would be the first one.
And I think the second one is the key context of the social pool. So the social brain is the most significant influence in some ways on a young person. So we need to use that to our advantage. So go with it and use it as a context, whether that's, influencing other teenagers with PKU, or indeed that wonderful intervention you talked about a camp, where there's a social inclusion and a sense of cohesion with a peer group, because I think that is the key to getting a good diet adherence. Go with the power of the social brain, don't fight against it.
And then finally, just the remembering that how adults around young people consider it, how they present PKU, is how the young person will consider it. If you always have this kind of look of, oh dear, this is terrible every time you talk about it and say, God, how awful and poor you, too much, then they will understand it to be a terrible thing that they have to carry. It's not about underestimating the significance of it, but it's about saying, it's okay, you can do it. It's a part of you, it's a part of your life. And they will take that attitude too. It's really important.
So Jane and Bettina, thank you so much for being here today. I learned a lot. I'm so happy I read your book, and I hope everybody's listening will read your book as well. Thank you everyone for listening today. We hope you have enjoyed this series and have gathered some insight you can use in your practice as a specialist managing PKU or other inborn errors of metabolism. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you, Kirsten. It's been really enjoyable. Up to date
with future episodes of Done on Nutrition Campus, the Feed podcast, make sure you subscribe on whichever platform you listen to your podcasts on. For more updates on the show, or for more educational content from Done on Nutrition Campus, visit www.danonnutritioncampus.org.